from Westside Church in Bend, Oregon. This is Behind the Message. This podcast takes you behind what we teach here at Westside. I'm Ben Fleming.
I'm Evan Earwicker, and we have a special guest in our brand new video studio. And our guest today is Joshua Ryan Butler. He wrote The Party Crasher, How Jesus Disrupts Politics as Usual and Redeems Our Partisan Divide, a very pertinent thing for an election season that we are in the
Not relevant at all right now.
Actually, the biggest burning question that I have, I'd love to start off with this. Leading up to this election cycle, feeling a little bit angsty based on how the process went before. And it was everything from the pandemic to all the political strife, the tension that created for churches. And I was so impressed with how you went about the conversation, everything from your posture to your content. So how did this all start for you? Why The Party Crasher? Why you specifically? And then what are do you think are the most valuable pieces of your writing?
Definitely, man. Well, you know, I think the biggest piece was just, so I've been a pastor for about 20 years, a little over 20 years now, and the last, like for all of us, you know, the last two seasons, election seasons have just been crazy, different, you know, and seeing it fracture the political division, fracture families, fracture friendships, fracture churches. I kind of share a story in the intro of the book of a church in Arizona that it wasn't our congregation, but it was in our family of churches that we were very closely connected with. And their church split over political division. It was 1,500 out of 3,000 people like left and left angry. And it was over, you know, something so – it was a social media, you know, a video that one of the lead pastors had put out on Instagram. It seemed really tame, but you had a handful of people who left and left angry. It was like seven people. And before you knew it, they were like trying to take down the church, rallying, like coffee shop conversations, rallying. Like they were scouring every church in our network. All ten, there were 10 of us, you know, 10 churches. They were scouring every church's sermons, looking for ammunition. They were scouring pastors and their spouses' social media feeds and just building a case kind of, and it turned into this viral thing locally where it was crazy, but it succeeded. It split the church. Mm-hmm. And while it wasn't our church, we were like family with this other church, and so it just broke my heart. And really close friends with the leader. I just saw him 2 weeks ago, and just my heart broke to see what this did, you know, in the church. And I wish I could say that was a one-off event, but I've talked to so many leaders nationally where it's been more the norm, you know, like that there has been so much fracturing amongst churches. So I'm not necessarily a huge political guy in terms of talking politics all the time, but as a pastor, I think just really going, how do we be prepared and proactive to navigate this next season well, you know? And there were some things that we did in our church in 2020 that seemed really helpful. Like our congregation was able to navigate the storm pretty well. And so trying to just share, I don't have everything figured out, but trying to share some things that would be helpful. And while I'm not necessarily huge into like, it's not like I'm watching national politics all the time. I do pay attention. But a lot of the backdrop for me on that front was more long-term interest in political theology, you know, so which would be the study of kind of how God's vision, the biblical vision of like church and state and the government, how those interact. So some formative experiences for me. One was I was pastoring for 15 years at a church in Portland, kind of in the urban core, where we had a church called Mago Dei. We had a strong relationship with the mayor and the civic government. But the mayor and civic government were fairly hostile in some ways towards faith historically, you know? And so as we were seeking to build bridges, and I'm a young outreach pastor, and just going, okay, how do we do this well? How do we partner and collaborate for the good of our city well? But what is kind of distinct to sort of the government and that civic office, and what is distinct for us as a church? How do you collaborate but not compromise, kind of thing, you know? And then I was overseeing our international partnerships overseas, and so working a lot in Vietnam and Cambodia, and so working a lot with the underground church, kind of persecuted church in Hanoi and northern region of Vietnam, where they were dealing with like, almost every pastor I met had been thrown in jail for years, had been in work camps, forced labor camps. They had had their houses torn down, burned to the ground, like because that's where the church met, things like that. And so there you're going, okay, how does the church relate to a government where there's explicit persecution, hostility at that level? Or in Cambodia, where it wasn't like persecution, but more just corruption. Like there was a lot, churches in the slums that were we were partnered with that were doing phenomenal work, but they were having to navigate local officials where they were trying to get bribes and bribery and money just not going where it was supposed to. And so all that was backdrop where it really fueled for me questions around, okay, God, what does your word have to say about a biblical, kind of a positive, but also not a naive vision of government, you know, and also the church, and how do these two interact? And became kind of a deep dive. You'll see in some of the footnotes in the book, maybe some books were really influential for me, but trying to read broadly on political theology about kind of a biblical vision for the church and the state and how those two interact together.
At the heart of the book is this idea, rather than just a left and right spectrum of political views, you describe four quadrants.
Yeah. So this was a core idea for us in 2020 that I think helped. And here it's just saying, dude, trying to map the lay of the land in terms of what in the world happened where things feel, for everyone I know, you know, it just feels kind of crazy today in our cultural landscape. So the idea is this, that we tend to think of politics as left versus right, which is true, but there's also a top-down spectrum that we can often miss from modernity at the top to post-modernity at the bottom, and that that shift has sort of split the traditional political divide, and it helps make sense of why some of the deepest fighting we see today is not just left versus right, but between different camps on the left and different camps on the right. And so these categories, again, are more descriptive, not prescriptive, so I'm not trying to say where we're going at this point. This is just more to try and map the lay of the land. But the way I talk about those, you know, so the upper left or modern left, I call the religion of progress, and here the creed is, we can change the world. And so there's a strong faith in things like science, reason, strong institutions, this optimism that, hey, we can use those things to transform the world, make it better place. The high priest of this religion would historically be like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. You know, like you can think of the worship leader here is like Bono, dude. I love Bono and U2, but there's a sense of like, man, you, singing these hymns that unite and uplift humanity, yeah, we can make the world a better place. Leading apologists here would be figures like Steven Pinker and Sam Harris, where if listeners are familiar, they are famous for kind of defending the ascendance of our civilization through like science and reason and so on. Now, I'll go more into more detail on those at our event that we're having here at Westside. Yeah. But to maybe shift to make this kind of a quicker summary, and the modern right or upper right quadrant, refer to this as the religion of responsibility, where here the creed is, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so there's a strong faith here in individual responsibility and the free market and taking ownership for yourself and those closest to you. And so the, you know, high priest in this quadrant historically would be like Ronald Reagan, you know? I'd suggest the baton today has maybe been passed to a figure like Jordan Peterson, who says, you know, if you want to change the world, start by making your bed. There's a sense of take ownership for yourself and what's closest to you. Start there. Think of figures like Jocko Willink or David Goggins. If listeners are familiar with them, they emphasize like extreme ownership. Like, don't just take ownership of your stuff. Take extreme ownership for what's under your control and under your sphere to do better with. And so here, the religion of responsibility. And I found growing up, it felt like these were the two options, kind of, you know, like the progress and responsibility options.
It even feels very familiar as you talk about it. Like, I can remember the news cycles almost and the pictures of the people and kind of the conversations that were around. It did feel like it was the only, and maybe it was, at least in the U.S., it kind of was the only two options, right?
Yeah, the two main options.
It's totally nostalgic about it almost. It's,
yeah.
It's totally. Like DARE commercials.
You know,
like DARE commercials, yeah.
Totally. Well, you know, and so to move to the, you know, the postmodern quadrants below, I think we have to talk about, okay, what do we mean by modernity and postmodernity? And in short, it's in modernity, there was a strong belief and optimism around, you can think of like a scientist in a lab coat with a microscope, right? So there's just that representing sort of a visual stereotype that represents a strong faith in things like reason and science and building strong institutions. We can change the world through these things. There's an optimism about human potential in this arena. Now, postmodernity is in many ways a reactionary movement against modernity that saw a lot of modernity's failures. So things like nuclear weapons, things like evil things like eugenics that were done in the name of science. And so there's a reaction that now says, well, we no longer trust those external things like reason, institutions, one big story to get us where we want to go. And so now the move from the external to the internal, where now there's a focus on creative self-expression, where the emphasis is no longer on discovering and defining the world, but rather in constructing and creating one's own world. And so my friend Jim Mullins, who a lot of this, the four quadrants came out of, you know, he and I back in the last election season, like brainstormed, how do we navigate this well? And so he had these visual stereotypes of the scientist in the lab coat and the artist painting a picture of themselves as the artist, mm-hmm. sort of this representation of that creative self-expression. And that takes us down to the bottom two quadrants. And so the lower left, I refer to that as the religion of identity, where here the creed is, oh my gosh, I'm having I want to say, live your truth. Yes, like live your truth. Yeah. Like where there's a sense of, man, just live your life. Don't let anyone tell you how to live your life, how to do you. You just be you. And here there's, you know, still a desire for progress, like in the upper quadrant. But now we no longer trust those other things to get us there. So we have to look within. And the goal is through, like, expressing yourself as how you're going to make that progress, you know. And here I think this religion is most prominent in the urban core, where, you know, if you think of upper, you know, the religion of progress, I'd say, is most prominent maybe places like Silicon Valley, upper right of responsibility in places like the suburbs. The lower left, religion of identity, most prominent in the urban core. And so we can think here of places like San Francisco and Boston, figures like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Elliot Page. Think of like my home in Northeast Portland this last year with race and gender yard signs, you know, pickets yard signs all around the neighborhood, with protests protesting the legacy of injustice, right? And the preachers of this religion, I'd suggest, would be figures like Lady Gaga or Lil Nas X, who are modeling the way of salvation through performative self-expression and continual reinvention of themselves. Right? Okay, so that's religion of identity. And now if we move over to the lower right, postmodern right, I refer to this as the religion of security. And here the creed is good fences make good neighbors, right? And so there's a strong sense here that, like, man, we live in a dangerous world. We need boundaries, borders to keep people safe. Insiders share codes of conduct, ways of living together that make for a better society. We need to be wary of outsiders who can threaten our way of life. And so in this quadrant, I think the this one is most prominent in the heartland, you know, like where you can think of things like Appalachia and the epidemic of meth addiction and unemployment. We can think of Detroit and the decline of manufacturing. We can think of the heartland left behind by the coastal economic booms. We can think of figures like Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity. We can think of, those kind of things. And because it's postmodern, there's a suspicion towards a lot of the stuff of modernity, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll hear a lot of the rhetoric in this quadrant of things like, man, the deep state government wants to take away your rights. Big pharma medicine is trying to push its pills, its vaccines on you. The fake news media is out to deceive you. The elites are out to get you. We need to rally together and band against those things. Okay, so that's very clear. I go into a lot more detail in chapter one of the book. Right. That's actually a free download if anyone wants to go get chapter one online. But the big picture, and I know those are broad brushstrokes, right? We're painting with broad brushstrokes. Mm-hmm. But the big picture idea is that there has been this shift from modernity to postmodernity, and now these are like four different directions that many of us are feeling pulled towards, and that the call in the book is like, hey, it's okay to bring your lean, but submit your bow. Like all of us have a lean. I lean towards a quadrant. Everyone I know has kind of a leaning towards a different mm-hmm. cultural quadrant, and that's okay. It's okay to have a leaning. The danger is when we end up becoming so formed and our ultimate allegiance becomes like the values of that quadrant that it ultimately becomes like an idol that displaces God as something more ultimate in our lives. And that that happening is what's fracturing the body of Christ in many people today.
Yeah. As I read this portion of the book, I realized how much of a modernity guy I am. And maybe it's our nature of, you know, you work in an institution, at a church. It's a very modern idea, right, as opposed to postmodern, where we don't trust those institutions. But fascinating to me, we talk about the nostalgia of that. But also, for me, I look at the postmodern identity and security values and think, oh, they're so wrong. But I can totally see, you know, values in the, and I would think for most people, they're going to find things that really resonate, but there might be some defensiveness when it feels like you're addressing some of the shadow sides of these quadrants. And does that come up when you're teaching this and with your church? And
totally, yeah. You know, I think one of the quickest ways to find which quadrant you lean towards is the one that you feel the most defensive over.
Yeah, right, know? That's
like,
right.
Like with some of the others, it's like,
hey, Bono is awesome.
Yeah, Bono is awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I know. I feel like I kind of got constantly be copying it. Hey, I actually enjoy this thing. So, you know, and, you know, one critique can come up, you know, people can be like, well, you're calling them political religions, but aren't politics and religion like two separate things, right? But historically, the root of the term religion had to do with devotion. That what you gave your devotion to and the social bonds and expectations that came with that devotion. And I'd argue that there's no greater devotion or zeal that many people are showing today than to their particular quadrant, right? Like, and part of the claim of the book is that on their own, these values are good. Like we see in the Garden of Eden, we see in the biblical story, we see progress, we see responsibility, we see identity, we see security. So there's actually something good that each of these quadrants have to bring to the kingdom. And I think it's really helpful as we enter as Christians into the political season, like looking at those who might lean different directions as people who have good things to bring to the table and recognizing that, man, I've got blind spots. I need people who lean different directions to point out my blind spots. You know, I think of the kind of the, an image that I have in the book, you know, is the image of Jesus' table at the center of the four quadrants. And the goal of putting it at the center, it's not trying to say that the goal is to be as centrist as possible or to just be apolitical or it doesn't really matter. It's not that. But it's to say that that actually Jesus is inviting disciples with different political leanings to actually come and to bring the gifts that come. And that we need people who lean progress to remind us that God's biblical story, like it starts in a garden and ends in a city, and God calls us to steward and taking it there, you know, with him. We need people who lean responsibility to remind us that God values righteousness and caring for our families and our communities and doing our work well. You know, we need people who lean identity to remind us that we're created in the image of God with dignity, value, and worth, and that, man, we were so loved by God, the beloved of God, that he would go to the cross and die for us. And we need people who lean security to remind us that God is a defender. He defends the, especially the vulnerable, you know, and God cares about establishing the peace and security of his kingdom and safety for people to thrive. And so so part of it's going, each of these quadrants actually has something really good to bring to the table. I think there's a reflection of, man, the gifts of God's kingdom in there. But the danger is just when, again, when we take any of those values and make them ultimate over God, there's a ton of examples in the book, I think, just ways that that can actually lead to idolatry that wreaks havoc in the world. When we take any of those values and we uproot them out of God's creational design and elevate them over God as something more ultimate, that is dangerous. And the reality today is there are people spending billions of dollars to try and pull our allegiance in those different directions, you know, in ways that I think are fracturing our families and our churches because we can no longer, yeah, see the goodness in some of the other leanings.
And that's one of the things that I thought you did a great job framing of there's a real strategy behind what people are doing right now to pull your allegiance, not just trying to get you to stop voting this way and to start voting this way, but to actually pull your full allegiance over into that. And that's where, as pastors, that is something that we have to consider and bring input to and remind people of, right? That the whole entire goal is to follow after Jesus with all that we can and participate in these things when necessary and important and with honor and integrity, but of course, hold our allegiance to Jesus. So my question to you would be, how did you get to this point where you could even, like, let's say, see the four quadrants, or right, or just kind of pull back and have this bigger, more grand understanding of the conversation. I shared with our church recently this pretty embarrassing story. I grew up in a small town, about 400 people. Yeah. Lumber mill and a plywood mill is what the entire town was built on. And I grew up my whole life hearing about how awful the environmentalists were, you know, and they would come and they would set fire, they, whoever they were, set fire to the mill offices, right? And this was the Spotted Owl showed up as the mascot for this group that wanted to crush towns like mine. And I stood up in a rhetoric class in college when I was about 19, and somebody started talking about environmentalism. I stood up and I said, environmentalists are everything that is wrong or evil. I can't remember what I said, with this world, right? And because the idea they're going to take our jobs. Yeah. They're going to ruin our livelihood. And you know what? Neither of those mills exists anymore. Mm. The whole town is a shell of what it was. And there's plywood up on tons of the windows. Mm. The people that I grew up with were right, kind of, right? My perspective of environmentalism or whatever, clearly massive ignorance. But I was at a point in my life where that was the only quadrant or the only perspective that I could really see and hold. And I had a lot of reasons, actually, right? I had some evidence to my side that supported my worldview. How did you, because I'm sure you had a perspective and a worldview as you grew up, how did you find yourself in a place where you could pull back and see this broader discussion in the way that you do?
Yeah, well, a couple thoughts. One is in 2019, towards the end of 2019, Jim Mullins, I kind of dedicate this book to him and mention him in this chapter where I outline him, that a lot of the initial, like the scene, the modern to postmodern, kind of splitting the left and right, was Jim's genius and observation, you know? And he and I, we were co-lead pastors together. And so in the late 2019, we found ourselves processing, okay, election season's coming up next year. 2016 was crazy. How are we going to prepare our people? And also recognizing that we had a pretty diverse congregation. So we were in kind of a college town. So you had, so we're in Arizona. And so, but our church was kind of right in between, you know, the college on one side and Chandler Gilbert, which leaned very conservative on the other side. So the college town tended to lean very left, both the students, and we had like 40% of our congregation was more younger student demographic, as well as professors and all. And then on the other side, we leaned right. And so I think that was sort of the anticipated pressure cooker, you know, of like, okay, and anticipating November 2020 election about a year earlier, and trying to think through how do we help give some language and categories for this. And so Jim really had a lot of that initial modern, postmodern, having to split, and then conversations percolating out between he and I and our other pastoral staff and team around how do we best think through and put language to this, and brainstorming. And yeah, the four political religions is what ended up coming out of that season for us as a leadership team at our church. The backdrop for me personally was, you know, I grew up in Salem, Oregon here, Kaiser, actually, just north of Salem. And if any listeners are familiar with A.J. Swoboda, I know he's in the Foursquare world. You know, we went to the same high school, you know, so we're like tears apart. So, yeah, Kaiser,
the real
Oregon.
Powerhouse. Yes. Really, yeah.
Lots of great things coming out.
Pastors and teachers. Theology of Kaiser. That's a whole
they really crank them out there. No football players, but so many theologians. It's really great.
Yes, but Kaiser, Oregon.
A lot of readers.
And my dad, when I was young, was a guard at OSCI, the state, the prison, the correctional institution outside of Salem. And then later joined the police force as a police officer in Portland. And I'd say my family, we didn't talk a lot about politics, we weren't heavily into it, but there was definitely like responsibility quadrant was kind of the ethos. And a lot of a military family, father in the police force, and a lot of the values, language, things were very much more to the responsibility quadrant. I went off to college, went to University of Oregon, and felt very much more like progress quadrant in a lot of where I was at, you know, and that shaped and impacted me a lot being in that environment. And then I pastored in Portland, Oregon for about 15 years, you know, a little over 15 years. And that environment felt very identity quadrant, you know. Mm-hmm. And in each of these, you know, so you have this formative upbringing in one quadrant. You have this exposure to another in college for 4.5 years. And then pastoring for over 15 years in more identity quadrant country. And And then the one that I had the hardest time understanding, I think, was more the security quadrant. I remember the 2016 election and navigating through that. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I didn't know anyone who had voted for Trump, you know, because I was in like urban core of Portland. Just if anybody did, they probably weren't talking about it, you know, just because of, you know, the environment and all. Yeah, totally. And then moved to Arizona, you know, and loads of friends and people who did. And so in all those environments, I think, for better or worse, one of my pieces over there has just been curiosity, you know, kind of insatiable curiosity, like, why does the world work this way it does, and trying to understand where different people are coming from. And so I think as a pastor and experientially having a lot of empathy, the more knowing where different people were coming from in those different leanings, and starting to feel uncomfortable when different sides would get caricatured, you know. And so being in urban Portland and hearing, oh, it's Trump, da 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 da, and, you know, just going, that can't be accurate, you know. And then especially getting to know, like, no, that's not like where, what's driving, where's going. Then being in Arizona, hearing the way, like, oh my gosh, Portland, it's, you know, in the way we could describe it, it's like, no, that's not, there's more there. And and yeah, I don't know. So that was, I guess, some of the personal history and backdrop. Great. And I think then as our church leadership began going, how do we navigate this, the quadrants began to fill out and help make sense for me personally, even of just, yeah, my own experience within those various communities.
Is this working, you know, as a pastor and leading people into this for much longer than we've been wading into your book with our church? Maybe tool for diagnosing the state of things and in relationships. Even tonight, I know a lot of people have said, oh, I'm going to try to get my parents to come. Yeah. So there's a sense of like, this would be good for somebody else. Mm. How have you seen, are people taking this on and realizing like, no, I need to assess my own allegiance to my quadrant, not just, oh, I need my radicalized leftist friend or right wing parent or whoever to come hear this so that they chill out. But instead, are people saying, oh yeah, my allegiance is split?
Yeah, no, I think it's been really good. There's been so many folks who either from, you know, reading the book or hearing a sermon or message on it, you know, have come up and just gone, oh my gosh. It's a lot of the comments that have been so helpful is like, I never understood where that side was coming from, and now I feel like I value them and can care. And for a lot of it, it's like a family member. Oh, I have that niece or that uncle or that whoever, and they didn't make sense to me, and it was uncomfortable. Now I feel like I have the grid that can help me enter into a relationship more and like press in more on that. So that's one. Another has been, I've actually been veering onto this becoming an idol. And like I, you know, was on the verge of going down the rabbit hole and whatever side. And this has shown a spotlight on it, you know. Another, I think, has been just encouraging. I've talked to a lot of church leaders just nationally who, the story I shared earlier of church splits and people leaving angry, you know, and just the difficulty of trying to lead through that, and some of the language for naming some of the pressure points that have been pulling at our churches, you know, has been helpful. I think one of the things that I've loved has been that, you know, two ways the book, I think, is different than what some people might expect. One is like the concern, okay, well, why can't we just talk about the gospel? Like, are we leaving Jesus to go talk about politics? And the hope is it's actually framing and talking about politics in a way that presses you deeper into your relationship with Christ rather than apart from, you know, rather than moving on from Jesus to go talk about politics. It's actually talking about politics in a way that presses us deeper into our allegiance and faithfulness to him. And the second concern or danger I think people could have is like, oh, are you saying just forget about politics, like, just be apolitical or say that stuff doesn't matter? No, I mean, the goal or hope is actually that whatever quadrant you lean in, you might come, you know, I think I found many people coming out of the book going, oh, I actually want to get more involved in my particular quadrant in politics and in whatever way or region I am, but I feel like now it's shifted my posture in terms of how I'm going about involvement in that and how I look at and relate to some of the people who lean in different directions, you know? So that's been rad. I think one thing that's been interesting, a question that's come up since I wrote it that I found really fascinating, is people going, hey, what size is each of the quadrants? You know, you talk about the four.
Oh, okay.
And in the book, like, they're kind of a cute, you know, a tidy little graph where each quadrant is the same size.
Yeah, they're
you
very
know?
Even, right? Are yeah, they really?
Very
Did
even.
You secretly
really?
Make one bigger than the other? Yeah.
Totally. And as I've been reflecting on that, here's my thought is that I think the lower two quadrants, if you go on, I think it depends where you're at. If you go online, I think the lower two quadrants are actually way bigger. The top two are way smaller, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that there's reasons for that. I think there's stuff about social media and online discourse that like fosters like that postmodern ethos. And so if you're living online and all your political opinions, everything you're being formed online, I think it feels like these are the two worlds, is like the postmodern, the identity and security, and they're going at each other. But as soon as you step offline and get more into like real world relationships and all, my sense is that the top two responsibility and progress are actually really large, and identity and security are really small. Mm. And I'm finding that I think that maps up with, like, you know, a lot, there's been a lot of studies done on like online discourse and how it tends to be the most extreme, like less than 10% on either side of the spectrum that are driving a lot of it. And you have the 80% or so, what they would call the silent majority, who like feel disillusioned by stuff getting pulled apart and some of the maybe postmodern trends and stuff, but don't want to say anything because they don't want to get pounced on. You know, they're kind of observing it, but disillusioned with it and not wanting to speak. And I don't know if you guys are experiencing this here in Bend, but when I've been in Portland, one of the things is this is more anecdotal and word on the street, mm-hmm. but I'm finding person after person after person who, like, the folks they are listening to are not who I would have thought. Right? Like, I would have thought, oh, you're totally identity quadrant. You know, and historically they have been, like, even friends, people I know.
Yeah.
And now they're all listening to folks who are, whether left or right, but almost like a high modern, like, reaction. So I think, I mean, one example would be like, dude, one question people, where would you put, like, Joe Rogan or Sam Harris or Christina Hoff Sommers or Jordan Peterson or Andrew Sullivan? Some of these figures who are both left and right, but like seem to rally together and kind of, they used to be called like the IDW, intellectual dark web, and some of that kind of crew. And my thought is, I think they're like high modern in contrast to postmodern. And because of that, they'll rally together, you know? And I think Yuval Levine, you're hearing folks who are like, dude, that maybe we'll use the language of liberalism versus illiberalism instead of modern and postmodern. But it's the same kind of idea of, like, we need to get different voices around the table. Joe Rogan. Like, why is Joe Rogan so popular? Like, I think it's, like, high modern. Like, he is modeling or whatever, whether you like modernity or not, like, he's modeling kind of that value of United Nations. Let's get everyone around the table and talk it out and hear what different people think. And, like, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, and that... I'm seeing more and more folks who are not vocal online, but like are following and being shaped by and listening to a lot of those kind of figures. And so I don't know what to do. It'll be interesting to see just where things go politically and all in the season ahead. But I think what it's done for me as a pastor is to say, I need to be cautious of assuming that like online stuff that I'm seeing is where people are really at, mm-hmm. because I think right. the reality on the ground seems to be way more complex and diverse. And if I'm just trying to respond to what's happening on Twitter/X or whatever, you know, like it's probably going to steer you off course from where people are actually.
And that's the challenge for us, right, as pastors, to make sure that we're doing that, holding ourselves accountable to the fact that all the noise might not be reflective of a reality that's in front of our face.
Yes.
Then there's the next task of helping our church, people in our church, see the same thing. Because that's what I've noticed in a handful of conversations that I've had, whether we've, you know, taught sermons that are coming out of your book or other resources. We're kind of trying to hold this posture in the middle of all of it. We get a lot of really kind people going, this is great. But my thing, they still hate my thing. And this thing is the most important thing. Mm. And actually we're in emergency mode when it comes to my favorite thing, right? Yes. And that I'm noticing is maybe the one thing that keeps people from going in past their waist on understanding the party crasher and just this kind of posture. Is there a way that you've walked people through that? Is there a way to walk people through that outside of trust in the Holy Spirit, so to speak, which is when I'm exhausted, that's usually where I go is,
yeah.
I'm just going to leave this in the Holy Spirit. I can't do this right now. This is a long, hard road.
Yeah. Well, generally it's been to encourage them. You know, I found generally those things, the one thing for folks is often a good thing, and encouraging them, mm-hmm. go for it, like run after, like get involved in that arena. Because the claim of the book is not that like those things don't matter. It's just that that the unity of the church is more important than partisan division. Mm-hmm. You know, but there's a chapter where I talk about even some of the areas where I do believe that the gospel, that faithfulness to Christ, calls us to take a stand on. You know, there are ethical things that we should be about as the church, and some of those things cross party lines. You know, I think there's some things that the left and the right would each traditionally hold. But so generally with folks, I want to encourage them, but I think the encouragement would not only be go after your thing, but also like the biggest impact you're going to make is probably not your vote. You know, like mm-hmm. go ahead and vote nationally, but work locally. So one of the things we did at our church in the last election season was we started, we called them prayer and action groups. And we said, hey, rather than spending so much time fighting with people online and, you know, getting sucked into the comments of the sections of things and whatever, what if we took a lot of that energy and we actually put it locally here into getting constructively involved on those issues in our local community? And so the first two groups we started, one was on sanctity of life and the other was on criminal justice. And so we had about 15 people join each group, and the commitment was, hey, we're going to spend a year. And we chose those two because we recognized, man, that they kind of tended to resonate with people on different sides of the aisle, you know, but going, we want to spend this year doing three things. One is intentionally praying about this issue together, meeting regularly to pray together about this issue. Two is to learn, both reading some of the best books and stuff out there and meeting with local leaders who are working on this issue in our city. And three is to discern and commit to a constructive course of action that they could help lead us in a church in, you know, something constructively in our city. And what came out of that was both groups coming back going, oh my gosh, after prayer and learning and listening and deciding, we realized the most important issue was not even stuff that's on the national narrative, like when it came to our city. And there is actually really powerful constructive action. We can jump in and get our hands dirty and get involved. And I used to oversee our outreach ministries at for 15 years at a prior church. And one of the things I found is like often those local initiatives of believers, I saw them almost like seeds that grew, like Jesus says, a small seed that grows into a tree. And there were movements across the state of Oregon today in foster care and nationally in anti-trafficking and in all these different areas that faithful local believers working locally, getting their hands dirty, has led to like transformational movement level impact across the nation. Way more than, you know, I could have ever imagined or dreamed, but it's just been through that faithfulness. And so I think coming back to your question, you know, for the person who goes, yeah, I've got my one issue, I would say, man, amen. God bless you. Take that one issue, get involved, you know, like mm-hmm. run after it. And yes, vote nationally, but even more so like work locally and find out how you can constructively get involved. Because too often I think just the social media thing or the vote can be an easy out from actually, if that's something you're really passionate about, God's really put on your heart, it's probably something that there's some stirring or calling there to really get engaged in a hands-on way.
That's good.
I love putting some action to what otherwise can feel like, okay, so you're asking me not to care about my quadrant, right? Be allegiant to Jesus, pray, and then ignore what I would normally be passionate about. But this act locally, work locally, I think gives people a way to say, tone down all the angst that's coming at the national level and look around. Who are your neighbors? And those issues that you're so passionate about, do something about it while you can continually submit your bow and find your posture to be one of prayer. We're going to be leading the church through, 4 or 5 weeks in prayer practices going up to the election. But I love the idea of also encouraging them and look around locally. What are the issues that aren't just trickled down from whatever the national you know, platforms are, but what really stirs your heart for people who are hurting or the voiceless or all those things that you're passionate about, what are those locally? Because there are so many opportunities for people if they're not so swept up into the national narrative to do.
Do you guys think that part of the secret sauce of that is that you actually get introduced to people in some of these other quadrants or that you might have thought were opposition, right? And they get, I think you used the word caricature earlier.
Yeah.
I think that's the most dangerous is when they're a caricature, right? And so maybe what you're talking about is there's these real places to get involved. I think you get introduced to real people on the other side.
Yes, totally. I think there's that. I also think there's a few things. One is becoming known more what you're for than what you're against. And so I think one of the big dangers with the national narratives right now is they seem to really be driven by more who am I against? You know, like what? Why are they evil? Why are they a threat? Why are they the enemy? You know, and we can spend all our time doing that and never actually get constructively involved in what we're for. You know, it's funny, my son, I've got a couple, you know, three kids, and my youngest, my 10-year-old, he came in the other day and he came into the house and he was like, "Janelle Bynum is really dangerous." I'm like, what? You know, and like we asked him, "What are you talking about?" "Man, she is scary. She's like an enemy." You know, like, dude, what are you talking about? You know, and I realized he loves to go get our mail. You know, the mailbox coming in, and so he's seeing these, you know, like mailer flyers that are like attack ads on Janelle Bynum. She's running for an office in Portland, or whatever. And so we had to talk with him about just how attack ads work and the whole thing. You know, but it's like, dude, in this innocent way, it's this window into like, dude, we're just in that national environment where it's more like, who are you afraid of rather than what are you for, you know? And I think the second is, well, you know, I give in one of the chapters in the book a bunch of creative options where I think we tend to just think, I got three options, the donkey option, the elephant option, and the ostrich option. You know, like kind of bury your head in the sand and hope it all blows over. But actually, I think there's a lot of other options for creative ways for us to be involved. And both as individual followers of Jesus and collectively as the church, I do believe that the church is the hope of the world, you know? And I do believe that government has an important function, an important task that God has given it. And it's important. I don't want to minimize it. But I also think on the flip side, we can minimize the significance of Jesus is gone. Dude, the church is my body, my bride, my people. I want to transform the world from the inside out through this upside down kingdom through the church as the people of God. And so there's a part of it going, yes, be constructively involved with government and with politics and everything, but also I think some of the biggest long-term transformation history has come through the church being the church, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, I don't want us to undersell giving the time and attention and energy as disciples and as the corporate church, you know, to living into that identity because we're too busy trying to convince everyone the other side is the enemy that's going to destroy the world, you know?
Yeah, it's good. Can you lead us real quick through some of those options? We can start with, I think number one is the local option, right? So you describe, I love how you write it in here, the elephant option, pledge your full allegiance to the Republican Party, enthusiastically support anything it does. The donkey option, pledge your full allegiance to the Democratic Party and enthusiastically support anything it does. The ostrich, bury your head in the sand, hope it all blows over. But then you actually provide, which I love, this definitely goes more into the what we're for and not just what we're against, right? So more options, what we can be for. I think you just described the local option. The next option that you described is the Daniel option. Can you give me a synopsis of the Daniel option?
Yes, totally. And, you know, part of this, too, is going, each of these options I see rooted in church history that we have a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're inventing these brand new things, but actually these are rooted in a lot of Christianity's history, you know? So the local option you just talked about, there's a strong tradition called subsidiarity, maybe one of the biggest influences in Christian political thought historically. But the idea here, in short, places a big priority on the local level, local knowledge, local relationships, local ability to do transformative work that has a monumental kind of exponential impact. So the local, the second option you mentioned, the Daniel option, and this is that I believe for some of our people, some are called specifically to political office for politicians in our churches. I've had multiple politicians in churches where I've pastored over the years, you know, and I think we find a constructive, powerful model for this with the figure of Daniel in the Old Testament, where Daniel is brought into the leadership in the heights of Babylon's government, and he models this faithful presence there. There's a story I love in Daniel 1 where he is basically, he exercises discernment, and he does something that I find really strange and crazy, right? He allows the Babylonians to name him after a foreign pagan god. They change his name, but he refuses to eat meat from the king's table. And I'm kind of like, Daniel, that sounds backwards, dude. For me, like, take the steak, you know, and like, but don't let them name you after a pagan god. Yeah, sure, right. You know? Like, what's going on there? And yet he's commended in the passage for it. And scholars are confused, kind of, why is he commended? What's going on there? But I think for me, that becomes a powerful illustration of when you're in some of those kind of gray zone, complicated political office stuff, there's an art of discernment that you have to walk through. And I think we need some grace for people who are in political office. Right now, being a politician is not a very popular occupation, right? You know, a lot of people are very suspicious, cynical of, but we should be praying for those in our churches who are, maybe it's not even national, but local office here in our area or in our state, be praying for them, trying to be support, hearing what they're up to, and that, you know, you don't want to be unfaithful, but there is an art of, dude, not always getting your way and having to work with people across the board for the best solutions you can come up with, you know? And so I think we see, I find a lot of influence for me here in like in the Reformed tradition, if we call like Kuyper, like Abraham Kuyper had this notion of sphere sovereignty. So the idea that different spheres of society have different responsibilities. And so the sphere of government has a different responsibility before God than the sphere of the church. And so it's okay for a politician to be trying to figure out how to promote public justice and protect things, which is there, but the government is not called to disciple Christians with the word mm-hmm. and spirit. The church is called to, you know? And so, dude, we don't want the government trying to force people or coerce them into being Christians, but we also don't want the church trying to wield the power of the sword to, I don't know, punish people in society who are breaking the law, yeah. You know? Like, so I think it's helpful to go, there's a legitimate role for government, and Daniel provides a good option for those who are called to office. The next is the prophetic option, which I think of here, like Martin Luther King Jr., where his I Have a Dream speech, and he's joined by 250,000 people at the Washington Mall, people who are hungry for a different future. And what's different here from the Daniel option is he didn't hold office. We're not talking about being in an office of political authority. So you're kind of coming from outside of the system rather than within the system. And yet, he was able to cast vision for a different future that was mm-hmm. compelling. It kind of shaped the cultural imagination. And I think we've seen this in, you know, different political candidates. Like, I'm not endorsing them or supporting them per se, you know, but endorsing or supporting them. But you think about, no one knew what libertarianism really was until Ron Paul hit the scene. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, no one thought socialism was an option until Bernie Sanders came on board. So, again, not trying to promote them, but to say they're an illustration that they reshaped kind of the imagination of what's possible. And I wonder what some Christian versions of that could look like. Mm-hmm. Things that I talk about in the book, kind of creative thought experiment of the prophetic loser party, where it's like, okay, we're not going to win, but putting into practice some of the like, crazy things Jesus calls us to, how that could actually be like a you know, so for example, you think of themes like Jesus calling us to confess and to take the log out of our own eye first, you know? Like if you had a party where you published a quarterly failure report, where here's all the logs in our, here's the ways we didn't live up to what we were trying to do, you know, give a bunch of examples where it's like, okay, you're probably not going to get elected, but could it reshape the imagination of honesty, transparency, yeah. ethical integrity, and so on?
We're here to get you to tell us who to vote for.
Tell you
who your favorite candidates are historically, all that stuff. I want a great Bob Dole analysis yes. out of you today. and the next one is. One of the more intriguing names, for sure, the scuba option. Yes. Sounds a little bit different than the prophetic option.
Yes, totally. So the scuba option is the idea of going deep on one particular mm-hmm. issue rather than having a lot of shallow, you know, like skipping rocks across the surface of a lake. You know, rather than have a lot of shallow opinions that just kind of skip the surface on loads of different issues, going, I'm going to take one issue that my heart is really passionate about, and I'm going to go deep on that one of really working on that issue, making a difference. I think here historically of someone like William Wilberforce, who dedicated his life to eradicating the slave trade, and it wasn't until his deathbed that he learned he had succeeded. Like most of the British Empire, it had been outlawed. I share the story of a friend of mine, Jenny, in the book, who has worked tirelessly for years with children, advocating for families with children with special needs. And now she's started an organization that's helped over 3,000 kids in foster care. And she works tirelessly, like young girls who've been sexually abused, who are victims of trafficking, boys who are in the school to prison pipeline, and hearing so many stories, people in our city who are just, oh my gosh, she changed the trajectory of the future for our child's life. Now, she's not in political office, but when the politicians are making legislation and trying to craft policy, public policy for these arenas, guess who they call? They call Jenny, because she's been a scuba diver. She's put in the long work going deep on that issue, and that's given her voice and credibility to have a massive impact, you know. And she's not very active on social media or online, you know. Like, yeah, she's had way more impact, I think, in that arena than many others.
Yeah, but what she does, it does have almost like this deeply political impact, right? Like this is a political thing. If you want to look at it through the proper framing, it's a deeply political thing to be involved with and very active on it, and unapologetic and all the energy, right? And yet, it doesn't always get framed that way. So I think we sometimes discard it, right? Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, and the thought that if I want to be someone who follows Jesus and in politics, that all my options are is, you know, try to institute a theocracy or be completely out. But what I love about these options and these models is there's ways to engage that don't look like some kind of militant, nationalistic theocracy. But yeah, we're saying participate. Find your model, find your option that looks like participating without making that the idol or saying all my hope is in the outcome of political elections.
Yes, definitely. Totally. Yeah, well, then also the monastic option, you know, and here the idea is, you know, we think of monastery, like I think the poor monks historically are often misunderstood. There's kind of a sense of like, oh, they were afraid of society, so they withdrew to kind of do their own thing. But actually, they were out to transform a corrupt society by forming an alternative community within it. And so secular historians look at how the monasteries actually had a massive impact on addressing poverty, addressing community development, education, national security, the agricultural transformation of Europe being credited to the monastic movement. Environmental stewardship. Sorry, Ben, with your
I don't still feel that way, by the way.
The protections of the spotted owl.
Yeah, I'm going to stand up right now and tell you about the evils of environmentalism.
Well, and here the emphasis is not so much on changing the system, you know, as much as on forming an alternative community within the system, you know, embodying the kind of values that you want to see on a very local, practical level, you know. And this is, you know, we talked about like the Martin Luther King and the Black church tradition. We talked about William Wilberforce and that kind of tradition. We talked about like the Reformed and subsidiarity. This one, though, I think draws on like more in the Anabaptist tradition is well known, you know, where there's a strong emphasis on like kind of, you know, a phrase you'll sometimes hear. I think it's Stanley Hauerwas who first said it, but like the primary role of the church is not to fix the world, it's to be the church, you know? And so it's kind of this emphasis on what does it look like for us first and foremost to be the church, to be that alternative community in the midst of a corrupt society, and to actually model and embody what we're for, kind of the good. And the idea that when you do that well, it actually grows and spreads and has like a, like that yeast Jesus talks about that works its way throughout the dough, that alternative community can have this generative impact that actually influences the surrounding society for the good. And so I think it's a good option. Sometimes there's some folks who are like, dude, I'm so disillusioned. I can't get involved in the political sphere out there without just feeling like yucky or corrupt or compromised or whatever. And like, what do I do? I'm like, well, throw in at your church, you know, but in a way that you're actually, or in your community, like in a way that you're actually following Jesus and being about the values of his kingdom in a way that really is being that kind of community.
You know, and it's intriguing because it doesn't disconnect from the community, right?
Yeah.
You just talked about how it's the hub of environmentalism or agriculture and even like a community and a way of teaching these things, the hub of their communities. It's very much involved, but while holding the priority of the church is called to be the church.
Yes.
And that rubs up against something that I think we all found over the last several years of, for many people, this desire of, no, the church needs to like run the world, right? Because we have cornered the market on the correct morals and the correct values and the correct vision. And if we own it, then we can finally make the difference and we can go ahead and run with it. But the monastic option really pushes against that, right?
Yeah, totally.
And when they stop trying to run the world and start being who they were, then out of that comes these innovations in agriculture, the printing press, you know, all the, even we talked about, you know, how in the early days of Bend, three nuns were sent from St. Louis out here to staff this basically a field hospital to care for the mill workers that were getting hurt on the river here in town. And that became what is now, you know, St. Charles, which is the largest employer in town and has been a major hub of our economic health over, you know, the last century, as well as, of course, help for medical. And that's a picture, I think, of when people live missionally because of their belief in what God wants them to do, but do it in such a way where they are grounded in what they're supposed to be doing. Out of that often comes community transformation.
Yes.
And what a beautiful picture of this monastic option, that we just do what we are actually called to do and not try to take over everybody else's sphere. And yet through that, God uses us to be transformative agents.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And then, you know, the final option is, I call it the reform option. And this, you know, I give a few examples, but there's some ways of looking at, dude, how do we reform the system? You know, we all know politics is broken. And so these can be things like campaign finance reform, ranked choice voting. Not saying everyone needs to necessarily agree with those, but there is often some common camaraderie across party lines of going, these are areas that could really help us have a healthier political system in ways that it's currently not working well for the good of anyone. And when you jump into something like that, you get the chance to work with people who are in different quadrants, different parties, you know, and yet there's kind of a common good element that you're working together for.
Electoral College, what's your hot take?
Yeah, we're going to switch this to pundit.
Josh, it's since 2020, probably going back to 2016, the last 8 years, we've seen a lot of shuffling and settling where churches have actually kind of settled into different ideological camps. A lot of people find the church that kind of matches there, and maybe more pronounced through COVID and then George Floyd and then another election and January 6th and all these kind of flashpoints culturally that really caused churches to see a sifting of people.
Yes.
I wonder what your take is. What has been the good in that, and what is the danger in that or the bad that's come from this, everybody kind of finding their people and right, churches splitting and resplitting?
Yeah, well, I think I'll start with the bad because I don't know if I have any good.
Fair enough. You broke him. He's been so positive this whole time.
A single tear.
Oh, man. But just to be honest, I mean, I think that this is the new church split, you know, that as churches are fracturing and reorganizing, I think that we're not I think the major pressures on churches today are not so much doctrinal as they are cultural, that we're in danger of having almost like four new denominations, like the Church of Progress, the Church of Responsibility, the Church of Identity, and the Church of Security. And one of the reasons I believe that that is so tragic is that Jesus died to reconcile a diverse group of people. You know, that he calls disciples with different political leanings. He calls tax collectors and zealots. And we can miss how revolutionary that is, you know, but like back then they wanted to kill each other. You know, zealots wanted to overthrow the empire. Tax collectors were maintaining the status quo of the empire. It's like Jesus calling Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ben Shapiro into a small group, you know, and going, you guys got to get along because you have me in common, you know? And that's not on accident. It's not like Jesus one day was like, oh my gosh, how does zealot get in here? You know, and like Jesus is intentional in who he's calling. And part of it is not only that they need him, but they also, they need one another as his people. You know, he's calling them to follow him together. And so I think one of the dangers is a couple dangers. One is that just theologically, the unity of the church being fractured by these cultural divisions, like infiltrating the body of Christ at that level. But another danger, I think, is on kind of a formational level for people personally, is that as you become more isolated in your tribe, you know, these different quadrants, you become more extreme. You tend to become more extreme in your ideology and views. There's a book, The Big Sort, by a guy, Bill Bishop. It's kind of influential, where he was looking at how Americans are increasingly sorting themselves into kind of echo chambers, kind of isolated areas where everyone thinks kind of ideologically the same as you, right? And one of the taglines in his book that I found really powerful was, he said, it was mixed company moderates, homogeneous company pushes you to the extremes. Mm. And what he meant by that, mixed company moderates, is that when you are in life together with people who don't necessarily see the world the same way you do, it tempers your view. You know, like, you can still have strong convictions, but you see the other side with more nuance. It forces you to actually become stronger in your own convictions, because you have to kind of defend them against, not a caricature, but, you know, like, real other ideas. But when you, homogeneous company, when you are only around people who see the world the same way you do, you tend to become more extreme and tend to view the other side as, like, way more dehumanized, way more a caricature, way more the most extreme examples get picked out. And that becomes your vision of what everybody over there thinks, which is really just kind of extreme and not what the majority over there thinks, you know? And so I think that there's a danger theologically for the unity of the body of Christ, and formationally as we become more prone to the idolatries in our respective quadrants without having kind of the check of people in the body of Christ who lean different directions can help check that idolatry, you know?
Yeah, because they do. There is a tendency that even when we're in these tight groups where we're just in echo chambers, there's this temptation when somebody comes and says, well, have you heard, have you listened to or heard someone speak from the other side of the perspective? And then they will usually cite, yes, I watched this video of the most extreme version of that argument from this one person that already triggers everybody, right? And that becomes, it's tempting to say, no, I'm looking outside my circle. Of course, I'm actually very much in the middle of all of this, right? And I think we all have the tendency to think of ourselves in the middle of the whole thing, of reason. But that's where it kind of compounds itself, right? Is that, no, I am looking out, but I'm only looking out at a very select group of people on, quote unquote, the other side, and really just using that as fuel for my own arguments, as opposed to fuel for learning and growing and listening and understanding.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
My hope for the church is that, as discourse seems, a healthy discourse between different ideological people, as that becomes rarer and rarer out there, right? Because everyone's so polarized and just yelling over each other. The church could be a place where that actually happens in real community, not just performative, but like where we really want to listen to each other, even if we have different viewpoints. And so I think that's a value for me, and I hope that is something that we can foster inside the church. Easier said than done, right? Because it's way easier just to find people that agree with you and all agree that we're all right.
Yes.
But to have that koinonia, you know, community that is actually built on Jesus, then we can actually listen and talk to each other, and because our main thing is Him, right?
Yes, totally. And I actually think that there's a strong opportunity for us, the church today, you know, which is, you know, a lot of the areas that we feel maybe many, I think there's a lot of opportunity where I think there's a growing cultural hunger beneath the surface for so many, for, in a world of polarization, wanting to be in the midst of a mixed community, like people who lean different directions ideologically, politically, and yet can be at the table together. I think there's a huge hunger. If we can model that well and create the space, I think that that's actually a powerful witness to a huge growing demographic that maybe is not very loud online, but is like really that 80%, you know, the silent majority that are really hungry for that kind of community. And the bigger piece is, I think, a growing hunger for transcendence, as there is this disillusionment with, dude, the stats, I forget the exact numbers, but the stats on, for millennials, Gen Z, younger generations, like the lack of trust in political leaders in a lot of institutions in society that are breaking down. I think there's a hunger that's growing for transcendence, though, you know, of like looking for a bigger story that can make sense of the world, of the spiritual power that is actually bigger than than what's present in just kind of the raw material world and all. And we've got the true story, you know, like we've got God, Christ as King, we've got the reality. And I do think that like that can, when you have God as King above you and his future before you, it puts politics in its proper place. It kind of releases the pressure valve, I think, of when you get rid of that, it's like, dude, everything's riding on this next election. Our candidate has to win, or right, it's all going to, you know. But when you've got God above you and before you, I think there's a stability and security that brings where it's like, okay, if our side, quote unquote, wins, you can have the humility to go, all right, well, we'll see. You know, we'll work for it. And if you have the, if your side loses, you know, you go, okay, well, not happy, but it's not the end of the world, you know, and there can be that humility in a different posture. And I'll just say this, actually, you know, like, I think that, yeah, this is me going a little Holy Spirit here. See, you guys are four squares. Yeah, that's good. That's good. This is my sense right now, right? My sense, and this has come through talking with some friends and leaders we've been praying to, is like everybody thinks that the election is the next big thing. It's the big crisis. And I don't think that the election is the big crisis. I think it's what's on the other side of the election, right? Because for so many right now, it's all wrapped up in, dude, our side has to win or else, you know? And when we, if we get our person in office, then we can do. But my sense is like, dude, that on the other side of the election, when whoever wins and gets in office, and the reality hits, if they're not able to fix and do the things that they have promised and thought they could do. It seems like the economy right now, like stuff related to the economy, stuff with the potential for war, like there's so many things that are just so gnarly right now that I think are bigger than any one person who's going to get in office, their ability to fix. And a buddy of mine, Mark Sayers, we were talking this last week, and he had this great phrase of, like, I think people in places like ours right now are at a state of exhaustion, but not yet desperation. You know, there's kind of the exhaustion of like, I'm tired, COVID was hard, political division, these are right. But you're kind of exhausted where you're still looking within yourself for like what resources to navigate it with. But the ground of renewal is not so much from exhaustion. It's when you're in a place of desperation. Like, Jesus, we need you. Like, getting to the point of having to look outside of ourselves. We need transcendent hope. We can't just get our stuff together here by getting the right person in office, doing whatever. You know, like, and my sense is, like, on the other side of the election is going to be where we potentially hit more desperation in the U.S. of, like, it didn't work. And things are still a gnarly mess, maybe more, and that desperation will cause many to be then looking an open in a fresh way to like, God, we need you. We need something bigger. And so I think for us as pastors, as leaders, as churches, to be preparing for the potential of renewal with folks who are desperate for not a Jesus in their political party, you know, like, but actually a Jesus who's transcendent and bigger and calling them into a kingdom that's offers the power of God, you know, the presence of power of God.
And sometimes it takes the failure of that champion, right? That it didn't work, to help us come to a place, especially where the church says, maybe our hope shouldn't be in that system, that person, that policy, but in something deeper and greater, which is the work of the Holy Spirit through Christ. And if that is the outcome, as messy as the next months or years will be, you know, come Lord Jesus, right? Bring renewal.
Well, I personally think it's going to work. Whichever one of them gets in there, every promise fulfilled, it's all going to be figured out.
You might be the only person I've heard say that either one is going to fix all the problems.
Yeah, and you know that by knowing me personally, you know that that's not facetious at all. Yeah. We would love everyone listening to this to read The Party Crasher. It's by Joshua Ryan Butler. Actually, we've been calling you Josh, so sorry. Joshua Ryan Butler. How Jesus Disrupts Politics as Usual and Redeems Our Partisan Divide. And So this is what it looks like for those of you who are watching the video stream. For those of you who are just listening, it's got some pinatas on the front. Yeah, I'm sure drawn by Joshua Ryan Butler himself. Yeah. And go read it, you guys. This is transformative for sure.
Josh, we really appreciate you coming and chatting with us. I know we're going to do more of this tonight, so we're going to give you a break here for a little bit. But really appreciate your pastoring us through this and our church through a moment that can be kind of scary. And so leaning into the way of Jesus. Thanks, man.
Oh, thanks, you guys.